It's Friday, December 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. imposes new sanctions against Russia, but will they outlive the inauguration?
But the real question is whether he's going to take action to basically lift whatever sanctions President Obama's administration has put in place.
Also ahead, a new ceasefire takes effect in Syria. The world mourns the loss of actress Debbie Reynolds, and New York City prepares for New Year's Eve. That's all on to Friday edition of International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Thanks for being with us. U.S. President Barack Obama has hit Russia with new sanctions over Moscow's alleged hacking and interference in the November presidential election. The president called the action a necessary and appropriate response to efforts to harm U.S. interests in violation of established international norms of behavior. The sanctions include the president's order for 35 Russian intelligence operatives to leave the United States within 72 hours. They impose penalties on Russia's two leading intelligence services. I spoke with VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. He told me that Russia has condemned the new sanctions, and there is a real question if they will live past President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration.
Well, the Kremlin has expressed regret at the new sanctions, called them illegal, said that they will destroy diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Russia, questioned whether they're even valid, given that President-elect Trump will be taking power in the White House here in just a matter of weeks. But at the same time, they've also promised an adequate response, they've called it, but implying very heavily that it will also be a reciprocal action, which could be both diplomatic and potentially involving counter-sanctions from Russia against U.S. officials or U.S. entities.
Now, 99 U.S. senators have called for some kind of investigation into alleged Russian tampering with the election, which included hacking of the Democratic National Committee headquarters, the releasing of some emails that were less than flattering for Hillary Clinton. Do you think that President-elect Donald Trump will be able to just stop that or overturn any kind of sanctions that have been imposed?
Well, it's going to be quite interesting. President-elect Trump, of course, has had some very positive comments to make about President Putin and about Russia. He's been fairly dismissive of the hacking allegations, including the latest ones, discussion of sanctions against Russia. So I would imagine that he will stick to that line as much as he can. But as we've seen coming out of Congress, there's been fairly strong bipartisan support for tough action against Russia, against the Kremlin, to send this signal. We even saw some comments from Republican leaders saying that this should have come even sooner from the Obama administration. So it's going to be interesting to see President-elect Donald Trump taking on some members of his own party if he chooses to do so. We haven't seen any comments yet from President-elect Donald Trump, but I imagine he's fairly outspoken, so we'll probably hear something fairly soon on how he feels about this. But the real question is whether he's going to take action to basically lift whatever sanctions President Obama's administration has put in place. And certainly that's what the Kremlin is hoping for. That's what Russia wants to see. And to a large degree, they're expecting that. Now, whether or not President-elect Donald Trump can actually make that happen once he takes office, when you have a fairly strong bipartisan support in Congress for sanctions, it'll be very interesting to see how that relationship plays out.
That's VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf. Joining us now in the studio is VOA's Michael Lippin with the latest on what social media is saying about the sanctions. Michael, what are the trending phrases on Twitter?
Hi, David. Thank you. The two biggest trends on this topic right now are the phrase 35 Russian, as in the 35 Russians being expelled by the U.S., and also the phrase ejecting operatives, as in the U.S. ejecting Russian operatives from the country. Obama's critics are not too impressed by these actions. Twitter user @metalbones59 writes, "Obama is ejecting operatives for alleged Russian hacking, but it was okay for him to tap German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone." Now, that user is referring to a 2013 report by German news outlet Der Spiegel, which said U.S. National Security Agency documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden showed that the U.S. had hacked into Merkel's cell phone. The White House said at the time that it was not spying on Merkel at present, nor would it in future, but it did refuse to say whether it had done in the past. Now, another Twitter user with the handle @adudeinplace2 writes, "Hey Obama, if you're ejecting operatives from Russia, how about you also eject the operatives from Saudi Arabia, China, and Mexico?" Now, critics of the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump are also weighing in on this. A user with the handle @SusanJ357 says, "Ejecting operatives should mean that the presidential election outcome of November 8th, 2016 is not credible, and therefore neither is Trump."
Now, have we seen any reaction from Russia on social media platforms?
Well, we sure have. The Russian embassy in London is getting attention for tweeting out a note saying, "President Obama expels 35 Russian diplomats in Cold War deja vu. Everybody, including American people, will be glad to see the last of this hapless administration." And to top off that message, the embassy also attached a picture of a duck with the word "lame" over it. And as some of our listeners may know, a lame duck is a typically pejorative expression for a political leader on his or her way out of office without much ability to do anything, although Obama clearly in this case did take action. David?
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. That is Michael Lippin. If you would like to tweet to him, he is Michael_Lippin. That's LIPIN. You can also send us a tweet. We are at VOA_IE. This is VOA. Time now to look at the top stories we're following in the VOA newsroom. The U.S. says a senior Islamic State leader has been killed in Syria. German police release a Tunisian man over the Berlin truck attack. Boko Haram leader says the group is safe and not crushed. Violence and fear stalk Rohingya villagers following a press visit to a troubled Myanmar state. And people pay tribute to those killed when a Russian plane crashed into the Black Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The Syrian government and several rebel groups have agreed to a nationwide ceasefire beginning Friday. As with previous halts in fighting, the deal applies to the Syrian military and the rebels opposing, but not to certain Islamist groups. As Edward Uranian tells us, the ceasefire comes after Turkey, Syria, and Russia last week said they were ready to broker a peace deal in the six-year war.
A Syrian army statement read on state TV indicated that a ceasefire would not include militant groups like Islamic State or Jabhat al-Nusra. Both Russia and Turkey have also agreed to hold peace negotiations in February between the Syrian government and opposition groups in the Kazakh capital, Astana. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov indicated that the U.S. is welcome to join the talks after President-elect Donald Trump takes office on January 20th. Former Syrian Information Minister Mehdi Daqlala told state TV that it appeared that accepting the long-discussed truce was in the government's interest. He says that the important thing is that the positives outweigh the negatives in such a truce deal, because there is always the danger that the rebel militias take advantage of the ceasefire to rearm and resupply. He insists that the agreement is positive because it allows the government and its allies to continue targeting Islamic State and the Jabhat al-Nusra. Retired Syrian General Haitham Hassoun told state TV that it was imperative that Moscow and Ankara prevent terrorists from using the ceasefire to flee the country. He says that Turkish and Russian observers will need to monitor the borders in order to prevent foreign fighters and terrorists from trying to escape from Syria and return to their home countries, including Egypt and Tunisia. Russia, Egypt, and Tunisia have expressed concern over what to do if Islamic militants fighting in Syria return home. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Coming up, we'll look back at the life of actress and dancer Debbie Reynolds, who died Wednesday, one day after her daughter, Carrie Fisher. And New York City gets set to host its New Year's Eve party. What security can visitors expect? Well, stay tuned. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
You're listening to International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. American actress and dancer Debbie Reynolds died Wednesday after suffering a stroke, just one day after her daughter, actress Carrie Fisher, passed away from a heart attack. The 84-year-old Reynolds was stricken in the afternoon at the home of her son in Beverly Hills, California. Reynolds started her career starring opposite Gene Kelly in the 1952 classic movie Singin' in the Rain. She was nominated for an Oscar for her role in the musical The Unsinkable Molly Brown. She was also nominated for a Tony Award in 1973 for her performance in the Broadway musical Irene. Reynolds had two children with the late singing star Eddie Fisher, who left her for actress Elizabeth Taylor. VOA's Sarah Williams spoke with writer Kitty Kelly, the author of several unauthorized celebrity biographies, including Elizabeth Taylor, The Last Star, about the early friendship, estrangement, and reconciliation between Debbie Reynolds and Elizabeth Taylor.
MGM was run by Louis B. Mayer, and the publicity people formed the Stars. And the Stars at that time were 1950, the height of MGM was 1950 to about 1960, when musicals were so important. And they were stars like Elizabeth Taylor, Debbie Reynolds, Van Johnson, June Allison, Gordon McRae. And the publicity studio handled absolutely everything about those stars. And they were almost treated like novitiates in a convent. When I did the book and I interviewed the heads of MGM and I was given access to the legal files, they told me that the, quote, Metro Girls did not smoke or drink or swear. Metro Girls never had sex before marriage. Our girls would never have done that, they said. So the friendship between Liz Taylor and Debbie Reynolds became quite a scandal when Eddie Fisher left Debbie Reynolds and went off with Elizabeth Taylor. Years later, Debbie Reynolds said that Elizabeth Taylor had done her a great favor. And Elizabeth Taylor agreed because both of them bonded and restored their friendship over their hatred of Eddie Fisher.
You know, that's kind of a remarkable story, because I guess at one point Elizabeth Taylor was then married to producer Mike Todd, And Debbie Reynolds was married to Eddie Fisher. And I guess the four of them were friends. And then Mike Todd died.
He did. He died in an airplane accident. And Elizabeth Taylor was absolutely devastated. And Eddie Fisher ran to her side to comfort her and did more than that. And at that time, Debbie Reynolds had two young children. And the MGM publicity people actually pinned diaper pins to her collar so that photographers could take a picture of her. And the sympathy that she had around the country at that time really buoyed her fame. And Elizabeth Taylor and Eddie Fisher got married minutes after the divorce from Debbie Reynolds. And their marriage lasted 5 years until Richard Burton came into the picture.
You know, I've heard that Debbie Reynolds referred to that time in her life. She sort of compared herself to Jennifer Aniston and Elizabeth Taylor, like Angelina Jolie, and then Eddie Fisher as Brad Pitt. But was that also, in a way, could that have been seen a similar situation?
Well, I think for contemporary audiences, it's something to identify with. But Jennifer Aniston and Angelina Jolie were not friends. Elizabeth Taylor and Debbie Reynolds were friends, best friends, and their husbands were best friends. So that's why it became such a scandal. These days, the Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt thing, I shouldn't say thing, but the split up didn't cause the shock that it did that Elizabeth Taylor, Eddie Fisher, and Debbie Reynolds did back in the Eisenhower 50s when it happened. Now it seems, you know, we look back on it and it's a part of nostalgia, but it at the time was really riveting in the country.
It's interesting then, years later, though, that Elizabeth Taylor and Debbie Reynolds, they became very good friends again.
They did. Debbie Reynolds reached out to Elizabeth Taylor, and they were both on a ship together and taking a cruise. And by that time, they both despised Eddie Fisher. And so they were able to become friends again. And they did.
Author Kitty Kelly speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. Debbie Reynolds received an honorary Oscar in 2015, the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award, but she was too ill to attend the ceremony. Her granddaughter, actress Billie Lord, accepted the statuette in her honor. Well, Saturday is New Year's Eve, and one of the biggest celebrations worldwide takes place in New York City's Times Square. This year, in the wake of terrorist attacks in Nice, France, and Berlin, Germany, extra security is being deployed to make sure the celebrations are safe. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio said at a news conference Thursday that more than 1 million people are expected to crowd into Times Square to welcome 2017.
New Year's Eve, we expect, as per usual, over 1 million people. I'm not quite sure why 1 million people want to stand in the freezing cold for long, long periods of time, but they do, and we'll be ready for them.
New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill says the city monitors and assesses the threat every day, but has no direct concern about terrorism in Times Square or on New Year's Eve.
We're going to have one of the most well-policed, best-protected events at one of the safest venues in the entire world, given all the assets that we deploy here. And all of this will ensure that New York City has yet another safe and enjoyable New Year's Eve celebration, as we do every year.
New York's Police Chief Carlos Gomez says that every caution, including the use of garbage trucks and so-called blocker vehicles to protect celebrants, is being exercised to keep people safe.
They'll use metal detectors to scan individuals entering the observation areas and pens. We will also deploy our full complement of explosive-detecting canines, the dogs, both at the event and throughout our transit system. Throughout the day and well into the night, detailed personnel will sweep hotels, theaters, and parking garages for potential threats and suspicious packages.
Commissioner O'Neill says that no city can guarantee 100% safety, but New York's preparations are as good or better than anywhere else in the world.
Can we ensure that nothing will ever happen? You know, this is it's an open city, it's an open society. But we have the security plan we have in place for Times Square. There are multiple layers there, as Chief Gomez, as he explained. So if you're coming down to Times Square, rest assured that it will be a safe venue. The NYPD, along with our law enforcement partners, will make sure we do our absolute best to keep people safe.
The highlight of Saturday night celebrations is the dropping of a 3.5-meter-wide ball covered with 2,688 Waterford crystal triangles that vary in size and are illuminated by LED lights. Each year, the triangles in the crystal ball take on different themes. This year's include the gift of kindness, the gift of wonder, the gift of fortitude, and the gift of imagination.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and old anxiety?
And some of the folks in New York might see a new uniform on some of the officers working to protect them. The police department welcomed 557 new officers and introduced a new dress code. Officers who follow the Sikh religion are now allowed to wear turbans and beards while in uniform, as long as the head covering is navy blue and the hair is neatly placed inside the turban and facial hair is no longer than half an inch. Previously, Sikh officers were only authorized to wear a patka under the police cap, a smaller version of an adult turban often used by a young Sikh. You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Have a safe day and a happy new year.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against corruption must become central to the broader strategy against terrorism, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Corruption, she said, undermines the struggle against terrorism at every level. Corruption fuels new terrorist threats, often in the form of violent extremism. When public officials and businesses can demand bribes with the assurance of impunity, the compact between citizens and government is broken. This enables terrorists to cast themselves as a better deal. As Secretary of State Kerry has said many times, there is nothing more demoralizing, more destructive, more disempowering to a citizen than the belief that the system is rigged against them. Over the past 15 years in Afghanistan, for example, the Taliban has been able to replenish its fighters by exploiting discontent with government corruption. The Department of State's research on Africa found that personal experiences with corruption were significantly linked to political violence, including violent extremism. Corruption helps existing terrorist groups sustain operations and infiltrate new areas. In Mosul, for example, smuggled oil enriched the Islamic State as it attempted to seize the city. In Eastern Europe, foreign terrorist fighters have bribed border guards on their path to jihad. Across West Africa, there have been reports of soldiers selling weapons on the black market to Boko Haram, or even tipping off Al-Qaeda about future troop deployments for a fee. Finally, corruption saps the government's ability to combat terrorist threats and ensure national security. For example, when Nigerian President Buhari took office last year, he found an army hollowed out by graft and wholly incapable of confronting Boko Haram. When Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi assumed power in Iraq, he found 50,000 ghost soldiers on the payroll, draining precious resources from the fight against the Islamic State. For all of these reasons, Secretary of State John Kerry has called the fight against corruption a national security priority. For years, the world has looked at corruption as a threat to economic growth and human rights, said Undersecretary Sewell, but we have underestimated the threat. Corruption is far more dangerous than many realize, and it is time to confront it with the urgency, intensity, and resources it deserves. In doing so, we can help build societies that are not only more transparent and accountable, but are also more secure and safe from the threat of terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.